So we'll open by reading Psalm 20 as our prayer. So if you would turn with me to Psalm 20. My Bible has a prayer for victory over enemies here. Particularly relevant beginning in verse 6 as we go through for 1 Samuel today. It's Psalm 20 for the choir director, a psalm of David. May the Lord answer you in the day of trouble. May the name of the God of Jacob set you on high. May he send you from the sanctuary and support you from Zion. May he remember all your meal offerings and find your burnt offering acceptable, Selah. May he grant you your heart's desire and fulfill all your counsel. We will sing for joy over your victory. And in the name of our God, we will set up our banners. May the Lord fulfill all your petitions. Now I know that the Lord saves his anointed. That would likely mean the king. He will answer him from his holy heaven with the saving strength of his right hand. Some boast in chariots and some in horses, but we will boast in the name of the Lord our God. They have bowed down and fallen, but we have risen and stood upright. Save, O Lord, may the king answer us in the day we call. The king referring to the Lord there. So in 1 Samuel today, when we look at chapter 14, we'll see how the Lord fights for people, how he fights for Israel in this case. So our plan for 1 Samuel was to get through chapter 15 this quarter, but we had a little, in God's providence, we had a little flood 1 week, and so we'll only get through 14. Long term, we plan to go through 1 and 2 Samuel over about 4 or 5 winters, so we can make a little bit of an adjustment there to deal with that. But we would have finished up the story, what's called the story of Saul, today. We are at another good stopping point at the end of chapter 14, but 15 would have been better, at least in my thoughts. So last week we dealt with. I'm going to call it the beginning of the end of Saul's kingdom. So the story of Saul starts in chapter 9, really, with that threefold, three stages that he becomes king. And he's going to lose his kingship in stages as well. Last week in chapter 13, after he had sacrificed, and Samuel came to him and said, so after Saul had sacrificed, Samuel came to Saul and said this. This is from chapter 13, beginning in verse 13. You've done foolishly. You have not kept the command of the Lord your God, with which he commanded you. For then the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom will not continue. And then it goes on from there. So that's the beginning, really, of the end of Saul's kingship. And we left off with this at the end of chapter 13. If you remember that we're setting the stage for battle, basically. What the king is, one of the things a king is responsible for is battle. On the board we have the location, same as last week, basically, but the Philistines are at this fortress town of Michmash. Saul's forces are at Gibeah. Now, those are only about 4 miles apart. But there's this big huge canyon that runs between them. And so really the best way to get from Gibeah to Mishmash is to go north is on the top of that map, is to go kind of northwest out of Gibeah or Geba, go around that deep canyon that separates Geba from Mishmash, again about 2 miles between those, and then come around from that way. So that's where we left off. But remember that the Israelites were severely outgunned, outmanned. You might as well have guns with what they had. Saul had, remember, about 3,000 soldiers that were selected by him, and the Philistines started to assemble a force in this area that included 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, and foot soldiers, essentially, like the sand of the seashore. So Saul had 3,000, but what happened was the people started to get afraid. He put out a call for all of Israel to come, and most of his troops went AWOL, hiding in caves, hiding in holes in the ground, hiding in cisterns, hiding everywhere. Some fled, so they went AWOL. So by the end of this time, Israel has about 600 troops against the same fighting force that the Philistines had. And not only that, but the Philistines had all the good weapons. And so, left off really towards the end of chapter 13. I'll just pick it up there, read a couple of verses, and then go into chapter 14. So on the day of battle, there was neither sword nor spear found in the hand of any of the people with Saul and Jonathan, even the 600 they had. But Saul and Jonathan, his son, had them, so they had swords and spears. And the garrison of the Philistines went out to the pass of Mishmash. And now you can break chapter 14 basically down into two parts. And the first part is that God, you could say Yahweh, saves Israel, and the second part is the people of Israel save Jonathan. You can really break it down into two parts. First part's through verse 23, and so we'll begin looking at that. So one day, or you could say, because it's referring back to the day of battle that was referenced a couple of verses earlier. One day, or the day came, when Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man who carried his armor, "Come, let us go over to the Philistine garrison on the other side." But he did not tell his father. So, important to note here that, and it will be repeated, that Saul has no idea what's going on here with Jonathan. And we've already seen that his leadership control over this army hasn't been good so far. Remember, he started out with 3,000 chosen soldiers, the best that he could put together. When they get faced with the Philistine army, they start to fall away. He's down to 600, even with all of Israel. And if any of you have been in the military or in any organization like that, you will know that it's not a good idea, or it's not a good sign, when somebody that reports to you doesn't tell you what he or she is going to do. So this is a total loss of control by Saul. So Jonathan then goes off, and he says he's going to go over to this garrison of the Philistines. And Saul was staying on the outskirts of Gibeah. So there you see it on the map there. And the closer you get to Geba, the better it is, the better able you are to see Mishmash, obviously. Mishmash is like a fortress, though, that area, and very difficult to access. And Saul was staying on the outskirts of Gibeah in the pomegranate ESV says cave, under the pomegranate tree, some versions say, at Migron. The people who were there with him were about 600 men, including Ahijah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the priest of Yahweh at Shiloh, wearing an ephod. Okay, so there's actually a lot being said there in verse 3. What's going on there? This isn't just listing names to list names. So this is, remember way back at the beginning of Samuel when the priesthood of Eli gets cut off, essentially. So Ahijah is in that line. So he's from that family. Notice that he is the son of somebody named Ahitub, which means my father is good, by the way. Ichabod's brother, he's the one of the son of one of the bad priests, really, that die in one day, Phinehas. And also, he is wearing an ephod. So that will come into play later, but let's just look at it a little bit. What does this mean? What does this mean? It's, first of all, the ephod is a priestly garment, and by what goes on later, it's good for us to take a look at a little bit of background from Exodus. So let's go to Exodus chapter 28 so we can see what this likely is talking about. Exodus 28, it's a long section here that we could read it all, but I'm just going to pick out a verse, about five, six verses here from 28. So this is, these are instructions for the priests as Israel has come out of Egypt, okay, and how they are to do with the tent of meeting and then at the temple later. So I'll pick it up in verse 4. So Exodus 28, verse 4. And these are the garments which they shall make: a breastpiece. So this is for the priest, for the chief priest. And an ephod, which is something that would go under the breastpiece. Okay, so the breastpiece is something that he has on the outside. The ephod goes under it. And a robe, and a tunic of checkered work, a turban and a sash. So this is what the priest wears. And they shall make holy garments for Aaron your brother and his sons, that he may minister as priest to me. Okay, so part of that outfit that a priest wears includes this ephod. Skip down to verse 15. And we'll find a little bit more about the breastpiece that is there. And you shall make a breastpiece of judgment, the work of a skillful workman, like the work of the ephod. So it's supposed to be well made. You will make it of gold, of blue and purple and scarlet material, and fine twisted linen you shall make it. So this is what it is. So notice it says the breastpiece of judgment. Okay. And skip down a little further, and we'll pick up in verse 28. It's going to describe this breastpiece and how it was made and how it was attached to the ephod in between here. But in verse 28, and they shall bind the breastpiece by its rings to the rings of the ephod with a blue cord, that it may be on the skillfully woven band of the ephod, and that the breastpiece may not come loose from the ephod. And that Aaron shall carry the names of the sons of Israel in the breastpiece of judgment over his heart when he enters the holy place for a memorial before the Lord continually. And you shall put in the breastpiece of judgment the Urim and Thummim, and they shall be over Aaron's heart when he goes before the Lord, and Aaron shall carry the judgment of the sons of Israel over his heart before the Lord continually. So that In verse 30, there's something that goes with this judgment. It's a breast piece of judgment because it's for making decisions. And the Urim and Thummim, it is not 100% clear what those were exactly. It's some kind of a device that the priests use to determine the will of God. A couple of main ideas about what they are is they are either stones or sticks that you would use for determining, like casting lots, for example. Some think that there were two stones, one Urim, which would be a plural, and the other one Thummim, which the closest meaning to that word is like complete. And others think, well, the Urim that begins with the letter Aleph in Hebrew, and Thummim, which is the first letter in the alphabet, and Thummim is the last, begins with the last letter in the Hebrew alphabet. So there may have been 22 stones, one for representing the first one and the last one, and these are plural nouns, so. Maybe there were that many. Now, maybe they were different colors. Maybe they had a letter of the alphabet on them. They really don't know what these were exactly. But they are used to determine, to ask questions of the priest to determine what the will of the Lord is. And we'll run into it later in this chapter. So we'll just keep that in mind. That's what that is. And they are used to determine, for example, whether or not you should go into battle. Okay. And the people did not know that Jonathan had gone. So that's how verse 3 ended. Stop here just a second to let you process that, what the ephod is. And nobody knows what Jonathan is doing. Okay. Beginning in verse 4, between the passes, so the passes are likely this way to go around to the northwest of Gibeah to Michmash, and or to go down to the plain around the Dead Sea and come around from the other side and come up that way. So between the ways to Michmash, essentially, by which Jonathan sought to go over to the Philistine garrison, there was a rocky crag on the one side, and a rocky crag on the other side, and the name of the one was Bozez, and the name of the other was Sene. Okay, so these are, if you this little canyon or this canyon that goes between Michmash and Geba is very steep on both sides, and likely that's what we're talking about here, is he's taking a way that you really couldn't run a fighting force, you couldn't bring a fighting force through this area, a really, really, really steep canyon. I'll talk about that a little bit apart, but Geba and Michmash, again, are only a couple miles apart, and if you're between Geba and Gibeah, you can see Michmash, but you wouldn't be able to see down into this canyon because it's so steep. And probably same for part of it anyway from Michmash. And Jonathan said to the young man who carried his armor, "Come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised," referring to the Philistines. "Perhaps Yahweh will work for us, for nothing can hinder Yahweh from saving by many or by few." So, good point here is that it's not that Jonathan is questioning whether or not God is able to help them, but whether or not he will. Okay, he doesn't have to; he's not required to. And Jonathan believes he will. And believes he's able. Notice what he said. It doesn't matter if there are just a few of us or if there are a lot of us. The Lord is able to save either way. So compare that to what we saw earlier with Saul and his forces. Saul, when he ended up offering that sacrifice, was concerned about the great numbers of the Philistines, kind of panicked, and it ends up, so he offers these sacrifices that he shouldn't have offered, and the people are terrified and scared, and Saul appears to be in a panic, and certainly his troops are. But Jonathan doesn't act like that. So in verse 7, he said to his armor-bearer, and his armor-bearer said to him, excuse me, do all that is in your heart, do as you wish. Behold, I am with you heart and soul. And Jonathan said, behold, we will cross over to the men. So now they're going to cross this big divide or this big steep canyon, and we will show ourselves to them. So not going to be necessarily a surprise attack. He says that we're going to go, we're going to let the Philistines see us. Okay, we're going to let them see. And if they say to us, verse 9, wait until we come to you, then we'll just stand in our place and we will not go up to them. In other words, they're not going to go and fight them if they see the people up on the hill looking down at them and they yell down and say, hey, just stay there, we'll come get you. That means they're not going to go up. But if they say, come up to us, then we will go up, for Yahweh has given them into our hand. We will go up, that is, to fight, because Yahweh has given them into our hand, and this will be a sign to us. So Jonathan decides that he is asking for a sign as well from God as to whether or not he should attack. He takes it from the circumstances, and he picks the one that would be probably most difficult for him if they decide to, if they respond in the way that he wants. That's a harder thing for Jonathan and a harder thing for him to deal with. So both of them, verse 11, showed themselves to the garrison of the Philistines. So what likely happened is they sneak down this one side of the canyon. They get down to a place where the Philistines can see them, and they decide, we're going to show that we're here. We're going to let the Philistines know that we're here. There are just two of us, and we're going to show them that we're here, and then we're going to see how they respond. And how they respond will tell us what God wants us to do. And the Philistines said, and ESV says, look, I'm not sure, I didn't really pay that much attention to what the other version said here. Look, Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they have hidden themselves. It's in keeping with this thing that I mentioned. This is, first of all, this is likely derogatory, right? The Hebrews, first of all, that would be a derogatory way to refer to Israelites, by another name, by another country, other people. But notice what they're talking about. They're just coming out of their holes. The Philistines obviously know now that Saul's forces have fled. They've gone in holes, they've gone in caves, they've gone in cisterns, some have crossed the river. They're just fleeing, and nobody knows where they are, right? And so the Philistines see them and go, oh, look. Now they're coming out of their holes. They know they have an overwhelming force. They know that they are much greater. They don't know what's happened to these Hebrews, Israelites. But this actually says, behold, the Hebrews are coming out of their holes. So a derogatory thing, but remember what we've talked about with behold. Often it means pay attention to this. Okay? Pay attention to this. The Hebrews are coming out of their holes, both of them, it looks like, where they've hidden themselves. And the men of the garrison hailed Jonathan and his armor-bearer and said, come up to us and we will show you a thing, or we'll show you something. And so they're responding the way that Jonathan asked to mean Yahweh's delivered them into our hands. And Jonathan said to his armor bearer, "Come after me, for Yahweh has given them into the hand of Israel." Then Jonathan climbed up on his hands and feet. If you've ever climbed a really steep canyon and you're carrying something, you have to use your hands and your feet because it's that steep, and that's likely what this is here. So he's coming up hands and feet, but the advantage there is that they may not be able to see him from the top. Now, once they've seen him, it doesn't say that he stayed in the open, okay? So he's crawling up on his hands and feet. It's really, really, really steep here, and they're going up the side. They may not know he's coming up, okay? Or they may not know where he is at all. And when they get there, and Jonathan climbed up with his hands and feet and his armor bearer after him, and they fell before Jonathan. So whatever troops are up there, they fall. That's the way it's described first. And his armor bearer killed them after him. So Jonathan led the way. The Philistines fall before him. And at that first strike, which Jonathan and his armor bearer struck, killed about 20 men, within, as it were, a half a furrow's length of an acre of land. It's probably about a half an acre. Is what that means, most likely. But they killed 20 right there. And we're supposed to see here that we understand that God did this, right? They come up on this huge force of Philistines. They're probably not all right there, but there are some right where they come up. They come up onto this little piece of flat land, and they kill 20 right away. And for some reason, verse 15, and there was a terror in the camp, in the field, and among all the people. So they're afraid. This means the whole army in the camp, in the field, and all the people of the Philistines are afraid of these two guys. Is that what it sounds like? I mean, it sounds like that, right? They're afraid of the two of them. So earlier, let's look at this little section here in 1 Samuel 13. So we can get a picture of this. 1 Samuel 13, this is from just the chapter before. And beginning in verse 5, I want to point this out again. So this is what's there. Now the Philistines assembled to fight with Israel, 30,000 chariots, some versions will say 3,000, and 6,000 horsemen, and people like the sand which is on the shore of the sea in abundance. And they came up and camped at Michmash, east of Beth-Aven. When the men of Israel saw that they were in a strait, for the people were hard pressed, people hid themselves in caves, thickets, cliffs, cellars, and pits, and some of the Hebrews crossed the Jordan into the land of God and Gilead. But as for Saul, he was at Gilgal, and all the people were following him, trembling or terrified. Same idea here. So when this happens, the Israelites are terrified. Same thing is repeated here, but now the Philistines are terrified, so what's different? Okay, Israel has seen the fighting force, and they are terrified. And now the Philistines see these two guys who have come up, and they are terrified. And the garrison and even the raiders, the ones that went out like the elite fighting force of the Philistines, were terrified. And the earth quaked, and it became a very great terror, it's what it says, or panic in ESV, but I just wanted to keep using that word terror because it's the same word used over and over again. Terrified, terror, same words. So does anybody have anything on that last line of verse 15 that says something different from, and it became a very great panic or a very great terror or a very great trembling? Anybody have anything different? Somebody's got NIV, I know. I'm sure somebody's got NIV. And it was a panic sent by God. Okay? So that's the word, when you say something like that in Hebrew, it was a panic of God, is what that would say. If you're trying to take it word for word, that's what it would say. It was a panic from a panic of God. So one of the ways that the word God is used, it describes something that's superlative, like the highest one. So a very great panic. That is a way that it's used. But it's also used to mean a panic from God. Okay? Like this. So I think in this text, we can read it that way, and that's the most natural reading for it anyway, is that this is a panic that is sent by God, and it doesn't make sense any other way. You got two guys that come up off through this canyon that we don't know, that you could never bring an army up through because it's too steep. And so we have a terror sent, or a panic sent by God. Now, why would that happen? Well, let's go on a little bit farther, and then we'll see. And the watchmen of Saul and Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and behold, the multitude was dispersing or melting here and there. So this is Saul looking across, or his watchmen looking across at Michmash. And they see the crowd was dispersing here and there. It's kind of like an ebb and a flow with wax melting. Melting, that's the same word that you would have there. There's something going on here that it looks like it might go this way, and then it looks like they might go this way, and then it looks like they might go this way. And Saul sees that, or his watchmen see that. And so what's going on there? Well, think about what the Philistines, the ones that saw Jonathan and his armor bearer, said when they saw him. Look, the Hebrews, or behold, the Hebrews are coming out of their caves, or coming out of their holes. Maybe they thought that they're all over the place, they're surrounding us, which would kind of fit this description of how they're going this way, and then the Philistines are going that way, and they're in great confusion, and we're supposed to get the idea here that, you know, this is how God fights. We've got a panic sent by God. They've seen this limited thing of two people coming out of their holes. They think they're coming out of their holes. They know that there are Israelites all over the place hiding out from somewhere. Maybe they're coming from this way. That means maybe they're coming from this way. That means maybe they're coming from this way. And as they start to go one way or another, they become confused. And so it doesn't really matter who has the numbers here, and it doesn't really matter who has the weapons here, but it does matter that Israel has sent a terror, or God has sent a terror on the Philistines. So just a pause there a minute, and I have one other question to ask. Anybody want to make a comment about this one way or another? Yes? Yeah, the earth quaked. Okay. Yes, so there was both. Yes, absolutely. The earth quaked, and some versions say that, and it was from God. That interpret that to mean as from God as well.
And the trembling was of God.
Yes, there you go. Good. So the trembling was of God. Yes, that would be good. So, good as well. Okay, so if this terror was from God, if the terror from the earthquake, from the people coming out of their holes, from all of the circumstances that are around this Philistine fight, how about when... Was God working when the Philistines came with their massive force and the Israelites became terrified and started fleeing? and going everywhere, hiding in holes, hiding on the other side of the, going across the river. I think the answer is obviously he was working there. There are other cases in the Old Testament where God, think of Gideon, reduces the fighting force of the Israelites, right? Reduces the fighting force. That's what he's doing here. There's so that only he, so that we can know that it's through our weakness that he is shown to be strong, that there's no other way for this to happen other than it's from God. It's not a force that is capable of defeating the Philistines. So Saul suspects that somebody may be involved, some of his troops may be involved in this mess over that's going on in Michmash, because he says in verse 13, "Then Saul said to the people who were with him, 'Count and see who's gone out from us.'" So somehow we may be involved. "And when they counted, behold, Jonathan and his armor bearer were not there." So again, they hadn't been, nobody knew, not the people, not Saul, that Jonathan and his armor bearer were going over there. "So Saul said to Ahijah, 'Bring the ark of God here,' for the ark of God was at that time with the people of Israel." Does anybody have anything different from "bring the ark of God here" in verse 18? I mentioned a couple of times the last few weeks that there's a difference here between the Hebrew Bible, the Masoretic text that is used for most translations of the Old Testament, and the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation. But in, again, until the Dead Sea Scrolls, that was an older, they had older manuscripts that were Septuagint manuscripts than Hebrew manuscripts. But there is an alternate possibility here. So Saul said to Ahijah, "Bring the ephod here." And four, the ephod was carried by him at that time, or something like that. And that's possible. It's interesting with the with commentators on this, they tend to follow, one tends to follow the Septuagint and one tends to follow the Hebrew text, and they get much different interpretations of this. But anyway, I would side with, like most of our Bibles do, and our Bibles aren't consistent in our English translations in which of those they follow, because we've talked about that a few times. There are a few alternate readings, but most of our Christian Bibles now would say, "Bring the ark of God here." And just a few say something different from that. But I wanted to point that out to you in case you had one of those. "Now, while Saul was talking to the priest, the tumult in the camp of the Philistines increased more and more. So Saul said to the priest, 'Withdraw your hand.'" So what does that mean? So there's no indication that a priest would ever reach out his hand to the ark, right? Because other places people have died for touching the ark, right? So withdraw your hand, what does that mean? Likely it does mean, because the ephod was mentioned earlier, that the priest was, Saul had actually asked the priest what we should do, and Saul becomes impatient, like he did with the sacrifice, and said, "Just give me the answer, okay? Just give me the answer." It's not necessarily acting in faith by Saul, not necessarily acting patiently by Saul, just like the sacrifice, right? So, give me the answer. But We don't ever know what that is, right? We just see that Saul says, withdraw your hand. Does that mean, you know, show which of these Urim and Thummim you have? Or does it mean, I'm not even going to wait for the answer. I'm just going to go, because look what happens in verse 20. Then Saul and all the people who were with him rallied and went into the battle. So they don't wait for any word from the priest regarding that. And behold, every Philistine's sword was against his fellow, and there was very great confusion. Again, this is the way that God fights. This is how God fights. They turn their weapons on each other. So now those superior weapons, it doesn't matter that the Hebrews don't have them when the Philistines start killing each other. Now the Hebrews who had been with the Philistines, and we didn't know about these guys before, the Hebrews who had been with the Philistines before that time and who had gone up with them into the camp, even they also turned to be with the Israelites. So who were these guys? So they're Hebrews, or they're Israelites, and they're in the Philistine camp. Well, that leaves a couple of possibilities. One is they're traitors. The other one is that they're mercenaries of some kind. So they're going to the highest bidder. So one or the other, you've got Israelites that are there, and they're in the Philistine camp. But even they also turned to be with the Israelites, who were with Saul and Jonathan. So they turned. Even they turned. So notice what's happening here, that as the Philistines become confused, the Israelites' forces are growing now again. And likewise, verse 22, all the men of Israel who had hidden themselves in the hill country of Ephraim heard the Philistines were fleeing. Even they followed hard after them in the battle. So even the ones, even the traitors or the mercenaries, and even the people who were AWOL, all join in the fight now for Israel. So it's become, God has worked in various ways to make this happen, so that, verse 23, Yahweh saved Israel that day. So God is the one that did this, in case we missed it. God is the one who did that and fought that day, and the battle passed on beyond Beth Avon. So that's the end of that first section where, God saves, Yahweh saves Israel. Now we're going to go in the second part of this chapter, which is that the people save Jonathan. And the men of Israel had been hard-pressed that day, because Saul had laid an oath on the people, saying, cursed be the man who eats food until it is evening, and I am avenged on my enemies. None of the people tasted food. So was this a good thing for Saul to do? So was this a good thing to put the people under an oath saying, okay, we're going to go after these Philistines now, and I don't want anybody to eat until we're done, until we've slaughtered them, or we see that they're in confusion, we're going to go finish them off. Let's not eat until then, or if we do, you're going to be under a curse. So again, a lot of times in these narratives, in these stories, Old Testament stories, it doesn't necessarily tell us that, right? We have to figure it out from what's said, if that was a good idea or not. Now when all the people came to the forest, behold, there was honey on the ground. After they have their oath. And when the people entered the forest, behold, the honey was dropping, but no one put his hand to his mouth, for the people feared the oath. So they were afraid. But Jonathan hadn't heard his father charge the people with the oath, so he put out the tip of his staff that was in his hand, and he dipped it in the honeycomb and put it in his mouth, and his eyes became bright. So Jonathan eats. He's refreshed. And one of the people said, "Your father has strictly charged the people with an oath, saying, 'Cursed be the man who eats food this day.'" So now, Jonathan didn't know that Saul had put the oath on, but at least some of the people know that Jonathan has eaten honey. And the people were faint. So we're not supposed to miss that, the end of verse 28. The people were faint. Jonathan's response is that, Saul, my father, has troubled the land. He's made this not good. He's seen how my eyes have become bright. I've tasted a little of the honey. How much better it would be if the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies that they found. For now, the defeat among the Philistines has not been great. So, people often make foolish statements, foolish oaths. Jonathan gives his opinion that this was a bad idea for Saul to do. And that not only has it been bad, it would have been a lot better, but he's kind of ruined the victory celebration because, verse 30, the defeat among the Philistines has not been great. It's not been a great victory. So they struck down the Philistines that day from Michmash to Ayalon, and that would be to the west, about 20 miles or so. And the people were very faint now, and they pounced on the spoil and took sheep and oxen and calves and slaughtered them on the ground. And the people ate them with the blood. Then they told Saul, "Behold, the people are sinning against the Lord by eating with the blood." Okay, notice that the text here, the Bible tells us clearly that this is bad. The people are sinning against the Lord. "Behold, the people are sinning against the Lord by eating with the blood." And he said, "You have done treacherously. Roll a great stone over here to me." In other words, give me a rock. Give me a big rock so that we can kill the animals on the stone. So at least he won't be killing them on the ground and you can let the blood drain off. And Saul said, "Disperse yourselves among the people and say to them, 'Let every man bring his ox or his sheep and slaughter them here and eat, and do not sin against the Lord by eating with the blood.'" So we talk about reading through the Bible every year towards the beginning of the year. If you would, and I mentioned early on that there's this app, Daily Audio Bible. So today when I was listening to it, takes about 20 minutes a day to listen to the Bible portion of it. It was on Leviticus 17, the part about not eating with blood. And it's pretty clear. Anybody that eats with blood is supposed to be cut off from his people of Israel. They're actually supposed to get rid of them out of the camp. Get rid of them. Okay, don't eat an animal with its blood in it. So every one of the people brought his ox with him that night, and they slaughtered them there. And Saul built an altar to Yahweh, and it was the first altar he had built to Yahweh. Then Saul said, "Let us go down after the Philistines by night and plunder them until morning light. Let us not leave a man among them." And they said, "Do all that is good in your eyes." So Saul's idea was, let's go get them, right? Let's go get them now. The people's idea was, that sounds like a good idea. Do whatever you think is right, whatever's good in your eyes. But the priest said, "Let's draw near to God here." So let's ask God. Let's ask God what we should do. And Saul asked then of God, "What should we do? Shall I go down to the Philistines? Will you give them into the hand of Israel?" But he did not answer him that day. So God does not answer. So Saul wants to go down. The people say, "Do what you think is right." The priest said, "Let's wait and ask God." Saul does that, but he doesn't get an answer. And Saul said, "Come here, all you leaders of Israel, and know and see how this sin has arisen today." So why won't God answer us? Why won't God answer me? There must be a sin here that is in place. For as Yahweh lives, who saves Israel, though it be in Jonathan my son, he shall surely die, and Saul doesn't know yet. But there was not a man among all the people who answered him. So Saul makes this rash statement, and the people don't answer, even though at least some of them know, but not one of them would answer. Then he said, and they may have also thought, okay, Saul knows that we have sinned by eating animals with the blood in them, so which is what we would expect. And then he said to all Israel, you shall be on my side, on one side. So all the people on this side, Jonathan and I on the other side. And then they're going to, and the people say to Saul, do what is good in your eyes. Verse 41. Therefore, Saul said, O God of Israel. This is where our versions have quite a difference in the English translations that we have. Some of them follow the Septuagint, and some of them follow the Hebrew Bible. And the Hebrew Bible is much shorter and says something like this. Therefore, Saul said, O Yahweh, or O Lord, God of Israel, give a perfect lot. That's what New American Standard says. ESV, which we usually read here in our church, says this. O Lord, God of Israel, why have you not answered your servant this day? If this guilt is with me or in Jonathan my son, O Lord, God of Israel, give Urim. But if this guilt is in your people, give Thummim. So those things that were with the ephod. So answer this question for us. Who is it? Okay, who is the one who caused the sin? Is it the people or is it Jonathan and me? And Jonathan and Saul were taken, but the people escaped. So now it's down to two. And then Saul said, okay, cast the lot between me and between my son Jonathan. And Jonathan was taken. And so that means, since Saul and Jonathan were taken before, that they were the ones that needed to be decided to. And so now the idea is, Saul says to Jonathan, tell me what you've done. Saul has determined that this is, he has asked for the Lord to tell him who sinned so that this would happen. Does this raise any questions to you? Okay, so Saul, we're not supposed to think, well, it's really a bad idea to cast lots, are we? The lot is cast into the lap, but the Lord determines the outcome. Saul was chosen by lot. Okay, God selected the king by lot. So what's going on here? Does it mean necessarily that Jonathan was the guilty one, the one that sinned, that caused God not to answer? Does it mean that? Another way to maybe ask that question would be, is God required to answer the question that we ask? Does God have to answer the question that we ask? Okay. So, or does it mean something else? Well, another way to look at it would be, does God get the result he wants when Saul asks? That's probably more likely. Okay, now let's not lose sight of, we're going to probably run out of time before we get to the end of the chapter, but what do we have for the situation here? We have Saul, who has not been patient to wait for God's answers before, and now he's demanding an answer from God and the priest. He hasn't been willing to do that. We have the priest, who is in the line of Eli, who God has said, this line is not going to continue anymore. We have things set up that go, okay, so what's the situation here? We have a known thing that the people did wrong by eating the animals with the blood. We have Saul doing something that we think is probably not a good idea based on what's happened here. They've been fighting all day long, and he's not allowing the people to eat, which in some cases it looks like, well, I mean, in this case, looks like the people were so hungry they just started to slaughter stuff and eat it on the ground and eat it with the blood in it. They were just so starved that they had to do it. So, and in this context, Saul said, who sinned here? Right? Who sinned that you're not answering me right now? I think it's more likely that not that God was indicating that Jonathan was the one who necessarily sinned, but more likely that God is working through this and working through, like he does with all circumstances, including people being terrified and earthquakes and confusion among people, to accomplish his purpose. So what has happened so far is that Saul has been shown not to be the best leader. He's lost most of his troops to start with. He doesn't know what's going on in his forces when his son attacks. And he also is impatient and not willing to wait for God's answer. And so what is the result of this going to be? Just read the next few verses, and then we'll close for today. Then Saul said to Jonathan, "Tell me what you have done." And Jonathan told him, "I tasted a little honey with the tip of the staff that was in my hand, and here I am, or behold me, I will die." So Jonathan appears to say that he is willing to be killed for this. And Saul said, "God do to me and also more, or more also, you shall die, Jonathan." So he's taking an oath saying there that you will die, Jonathan. And the people said to Saul, "Shall Jonathan die, who has worked this great salvation in Israel?" So they speak up, and then they say, "Far be it. As Yahweh lives, there shall not be one hair on his head fall to the ground, for he has worked with God this day." So the people are questioning Saul's authority, right? They're questioning. Before, when he delivered a victory to them, they all followed him, okay? And now they're seeing something else. So does God get the result he wants? Jonathan lives. The people see that Saul has been foolish. You know, they may or may not know about the priesthood that's following them around, that they are a priesthood that is not fit for the duty. So the people ransomed Jonathan, or they rescued Jonathan, so that he did not die. And then Saul went up from pursuing the Philistines, and the Philistines went back to their place. So what happens in the rest of this chapter is there's a summary of the kingship of Saul. So it summarizes, like we had at the end of Samuel's life, that there, it was good all around, there was peace, no problems. At the end of Saul's section here, looks like a similar thing. He fights with others all the days of his kingship. He is successful in most of those things, and then it just cuts off and we go into the next stage of the fall of Saul, or the end of Saul's kingship. So next December, we'll take that up. So next week is continuing in Mark in here with Jim Pollard. Thanks.